And we are here in Jerusalem, in the Emek Rephaim area at the Shalem Center, with Yossi Klein Halevi, at least one more time. Yossi, a while ago I ran into a video of yours, of you, talking to a group called Common Ground. And one of the things you talked in there about was about God in Israel, in the context, God, there should be more godness or something of that nature in our state, in our politics. And I really, really was curious as to what you meant by that, and I would like to hear about it and be able to share it with our listeners.
Yoram, not more God in our state and our politics, more God in our Judaism, more God in the life of our society, in our individual spiritual life. Absolutely not more God in our political system, because that's the surest way of making sure that there'll be less God. So I would go even further in that, not just God, but Judaism, Jewish identity. I would like to see an Israel that is more Jewish on the grassroots level, more Jewishly identified, and less Jewish on the official level. On the official level, we need to be, not to do away with a Jewish state, our identity is a Jewish state, then you're destroying the essence of who we are, but to expand our national identity to include Israeli citizens who aren't Jewish, so that when we think of the word Israeli, we don't automatically translate that into Jew. So in that sense, I'd like to see less Judaism on the official level, and certainly do away with Orthodox Judaism as the official version of Judaism in this country. That goes without saying.
As an Orthodox Jew, you say that.
I'm a post-Orthodox Jew, Yarm, and we could have a whole discussion on what that means. But you know, that's very much I'm definitively post-Orthodox, and I owe a lot to Orthodoxy in the evolution of my own Judaism, my own spiritual identity. But I came to the conclusion that Orthodoxy is not my spiritual home, and I'm not part of the Orthodox community anymore. So that brings me back to the question that you began with, of more God. What kind of God and where? Where do we want more godliness to manifest? I think that the frustration that I was trying to express in that video that you mentioned was the sense that we have become a people that we define ourselves, the components of the Jewish people, each of us in the different ways we define ourselves, in every conceivable way other than our relationship with God. And it seems to me that the essence of Judaism, the essence of and this is obviously my understanding of Jewish history, is that it is the expression of the love between God and the Jewish people. That's what Judaism is, and that's what Jewish history in a very fitful way expresses, because this is a tumultuous relationship, a relationship where God accuses us of infidelity, and then when bad things happen to the Jews, we accuse him of infidelity. And this is a not an easy love affair, but it's the longest love affair in history, and that is the heart of what I understand Jewish history to be. It's the attempt of a people to express in its historical experience the presence of God. And when I look at Jewish life today, for very good reasons, very good historical, psychological reasons, we are about everything but God. And that includes the Orthodox. The Orthodox are about halakha. The Orthodox are about Torah. Now, in the minds of Orthodox Jews, that's synonymous with God, but it isn't necessarily so. And sometimes halakha can become not a means of serving God, but of substituting God with a man-made system. A system in which God, to a large extent, can be superfluous. Halakha can be self-impelling. It has a logic of its own. It's an all-encompassing system. It's a lifestyle. And when it's lived in halakha, when it's lived with a certain state of consciousness, certainly can bring you closer to God. And that was its original purpose. But what I see happen, what I see has happened in Orthodox life in recent decades, maybe the last few centuries, after that initial flowering of Hasidism, and then perhaps the first moments of the Musar movement, I see a very, very steep decline in the God consciousness of Orthodox Judaism. To say nothing of the non-Orthodox denominations, where God is often a kind of embarrassment. And the conservative movement has taken on, to my mind, some of the most negative traits of Orthodoxy in its disinterest in God. Now that's an unfair generalization. All these generalizations I'm making are unfair. Generalizations are always unfair. But one thing we know that we've learned in Israeli society is that stereotypes are there for a reason. And Israelis tend to be, here's another generalization, Israelis love generalizations.
We do. Generally speaking, you're right.
So there's a sense of frustration that I have as someone who sees his own Judaism as being an expression of an attempt to place God at the center of one's being. And Judaism today is about ethnicity, it's about tikkun olam, it's about halakha, it's about Zionism, it's about everything except what it's supposed to be about. Now, all of those expressions that I've just mentioned are, of course, legitimate, even essential facets of Jewish identity, but they're spokes. They're not the heart of the wheel, and we need to go back to the heart of the wheel. And again, there are very good reasons for why we've displaced Judaism from the center of our Jewishness. And we are still a deeply wounded generation. I think of that wonderful poem by Itzhak Manger, the great Yiddish poet, who wrote in Sinai we accepted the Torah, and in Lublin we gave it back. And to some extent, I think that we don't have a natural language of intimacy with God that works for our generation. And I don't mean a philosophical approach. I mean a devotional language, a language of talking with God, where one isn't embarrassed to sit and talk to God.
Do you have an idea of what that would be like?
Yes.
Do you experience that yourself?
Yeah, I experience that language of intimacy with God through silence. Because it's also hard for me to have a language. And when I try to talk to God, I rely more on Rabbi Nachman's approach, which is just speak to God as you would to a friend. Use your vernacular. I find the Siddur, by and large, unapproachable. For all kinds of reasons, the repetition, the language. There are certain prayers that have meant an enormous amount to me over the years. I find the Siddur, as it's constructed, to be less and less inviting for me personally. I don't have a natural home in it anymore. And I find that my own language of intimacy with God is through meditation. which is, of course, a language of silence. It's an attempt to try to still the chatter of our minds, of our surroundings, and to go back to what the Tanakh describes as the still small voice, which is where, you know, God is not in the storm. God is in silence.
Which is not a particularly Jewish way.
Well, there's an argument there, Yaron. There's an argument there. Arya Kaplan, who is one of the great Jewish mystics of our generation, died in his 40s, and left behind the most significant library, certainly in English, of works on Jewish mysticism. Came out with two seminal works on the question of meditation. He wrote three books on meditation. The third, which is his most popular, is in some ways his least interesting. The two books I'm thinking of is Meditation in the Bible and Meditation in Kabbalah. They're both very difficult works, very technical works. What he does in the first book, Meditation in the Bible, is retranslate key terms, especially in the Nevi'im, words that he feels were misunderstood and whose original meaning were forgotten with the centuries, and that he goes back and he shows how these are terms of meditation techniques, and he shows how the Nevi'im were trained through meditation in order to become receptacles of Ruach HaKodesh, of the divine spirit of prophecy. His book, Meditation and Kabbalah, a series of mini manuals, different schools of Kabbalah, in which he, again, very technical, dealing with the stuff of visualization, how the different schools in Kabbalah used the name of God, the Yud Hey Vav Hey, to put on your forehead to concentrate. And I deliberately say the explicit letters rather than a euphemism, because I believe that that's part of our reclaiming a language of intimacy with God. The euphemisms deaden our language of intimacy.
For years I've had this conversation with several people. My feeling was that the situation that we're in as a human community is far too critical to allow that space, the distance between us and it, that using those other terms is.
That's so exactly put. And Birshutcha, with your permission, I'd like to elaborate on exactly what you've just said, which is the situation of the human community. And what does it mean for us as a people to reclaim our relationship with God? What are the implications of that for humanity?
And for ourselves.
Okay, let's start with ourselves.
Yeah.
Okay, for ourselves, it means coming back to who we are, coming back to how we defined ourselves as a people for close to 4,000 years. And it's only in the last two centuries where we began developing alternative definitions of who we are, self-definitions, that were very useful and necessary at a certain point in history in coping with the emergence of the West, with the shift of the Jewish people from traditional societies into Western culture. It's what made Zionism possible. So we needed to take a break from that unbroken self-definition of the Jewish people as a people that defines itself by the quality of its relationship with God. Now, I would argue that those various strategies haven't failed. Secular Zionism did not fail. Reform Judaism did not fail. I have enormous veneration, not just respect, for those early reformers, You read, you know, that first generation or two of Reform rabbis, the courage that it took for these rabbis who themselves were Orthodox. Where did they come from? They were steeped in traditional Judaism to say, this can't carry us into the future. We need something new. And that the strategies that they devised were imperfect. They were flawed. But and they've run their course. But that doesn't take away either from their courage, their genius, and to some extent the usefulness of the strategies that the non-Orthodox denominations devised. In the same way, though, that the Reform movement realized that it could not uproot Jewish nationhood from Jewish identity and remain authentically Jewish, Reform Judaism in this generation, to its credit, is realizing that it has to take God more seriously. So we're really at a turning point, I think. And certainly you look around Israeli society today, there's a deep hunger for God. It's expressed, and you and I have talked about this, it's expressed in some ways most compellingly in Israeli rock music. It's one of the great gifts of living in Israel is the endless surprises of
radio.
You know, you turn on the radio and you say, wow, you know, this is really just profound. You know, who expected it to come from Israeli rock and roll? But there it is.
One of the early examples of this phenomenon was the band Sheva, where we hear the influence of their post-army trip to India, which had become traditional for most young Israelis. Here they'll sing Shir HaMalot, the Song of Ascent, which is Psalm 120. It was sung by the pilgrims as they went up to Jerusalem during the three pilgrimage festivals in the days of the temple. It's also traditionally sung on Sabbath afternoon.
What were the three festivals?
The three pilgrimage festivals, Passover, Pesach, Pentecost, Shavuot, and Sukkot, Tabernacles.
So we're really living at a time where Jews are looking for a relationship with God, individually and collectively in our national identity. But it needs reconnection, the process of return in the deepest sense, and I don't mean that the corruption of that word, you know, the chazara b'tshuva, it's become in a way vulgarized. It's become something technical. You know, well, which mitzvot are you doing? How many? How do you do it? Do you turn lights on and off on Shabbos? It's the vulgarization of a very profound process that Ruff Cook wrote about in just the most powerful way. It's a turning of the soul. And in Israel especially, you feel people have a desperate need for turning of the soul. And we know, I think, that it's just not going to work anymore. This place isn't going to work if we don't get to that next level of reconnecting to who we really are. And who we are at our best is a people that took on the impossible task of living in the glare of God's presence.
Who else are we really? What else constitutes our realness? Our real we, or does that itself encompass everything that might be? And I've told you this over the years, I have the feeling that they, meaning the Arabs, Ki'ilu, have won because as a consequence of this endless conflict that we're involved in, we have become less and less who we really are. And I sometimes think I know what that means, and I'm wondering what you think that means.
Well, Yoram, I don't blame this on the conflict. I think that in a certain sense, the conflict is pushing more and more of us to deal with the basic questions of life and death and the soul and meaning in a way that in Israel everything is so raw because of the conflict that we don't have the luxury to cover up those basic questions of meaning in a way that you can in the West. You can live your life for a long time without coming up against reality and the rawness of reality, and we don't have that luxury. I think that among Western societies, no people lives with a greater intimacy with death than we do, and that leads more and more of us to those basic questions of meaning. So in that sense, the conflict is working in tandem with that process of return.
What I meant about how the conflict affects us is very well, we see it very clearly in the national religious community. Here's a community which has dedicated itself to being authentic Jews, dedicated itself to religion, Jewish religion, and to God in the sense. And yet it's where it spends most of its time and most of its passion has to do with this conflict with these other people. And I feel it seems to me that it takes away, that there's less and less energy and time that they invest in the other part of who we are.
I think you're right, but there are very positive signs among part of the younger religious Zionist community where you see real struggles and a real longing for spirituality. You look at who are the popular spiritual teachers among young religious Zionists today, and it's Ruff Cook the father more than Ruff Cook the son, it seems to me. It's Rabbi Nachman, it's Shlomo Kalbach. You know, we're seeing a turn not only among young secularists, but among young religious Zionists, a longing for God, and that I think is I think the crisis, the God crisis, is not only among secular Israelis, also among Orthodox Israelis. That's what we were talking about before, and that's that opens the way for a new common ground to emerge here, what we can call vaguely and in an unsatisfactory way, a spiritual ground, where post-Orthodox and post-secular will meet, and to some extent I think are already beginning to meet. But we've talked about so many things, and I wanted to get back to the two questions that you raised. One is, what does this mean for us to get back to ourselves, to get back to a relationship with God? And what does it mean, what implications does that have for our relationship with the rest of humanity? In terms of our getting back to ourselves, It has to begin bottom up. It has to begin on the individual level, where each of us looks at the quality of his or her spiritual life and needs to find those areas that are wanting and make a commitment to take the next step in working on oneself. And that has two levels. It's the negative and the positive. The negative is working on those obstacles within us that keep us from growing spiritually, that keep us from being who we really are, which is we are souls. It keeps our souls from shining through our personalities, our bodies. And that's the negative work we have to do. And the positive work is finding those tools that allow us to keep God in our minds for as much of the day as possible, where God gradually becomes a living presence in our life. And God is not an abstraction. God is not an idea. Monotheism is not an idea. It's a lived experience of oneness, where you gradually begin to experience reality as an interchangeable whole. That is monotheism. It's not a philosophy. It's not a theology. It's not what I believe or don't believe. And that is a process of gradually expanding one's consciousness to take in more and more of God. And it means you could be doing whatever you do during the course of your day, and if you have regular intervals where you stop for 3 minutes, 5 minutes, and you recall, recall God's presence, recall what's important for you. And or you could be maintaining an ongoing Rebbe Nachman style dialogue in your head, a silent dialogue, where you're just constantly turning to God, help me with this, I need help with that. And Rebbe Nachman said that ask God for the smallest needs that you have. Don't worry about being a nudnik with God. Ask him for whatever you need. And that's another approach. Meditation is a third approach. And these are all, of course, complementary. And the more one grapples with making the transition from a material-based consciousness to a God-centered consciousness, the more you realize that all of these techniques are necessary. And one helps the other. So meditation, I think the revival of Jewish meditation, which is beginning in our generation, is to my mind the most hopeful sign of the resurgence of a God-centered Judaism, because what meditation allows you to experience is it allows you to enter, to partake of the being of God, which is silence. And when you enter that silence and you focus your thoughts, and there is nothing more difficult than that work, where you see how hard it is to hold one thought for 30 seconds. And when you try to expand that, 40 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, and then you begin to touch certain places that you never knew you were able to encounter. And it's hit and run, because it's very, very hard, almost impossible to sustain that. But with years and years of struggle and practice, eventually, so we're told, one can be able to hold that place. And I think this has a lot to do with the inner meaning of the Israeli-India connection, which is something that's developed in our generation, with the reemergence of Jewish meditation, with the hunger for a restoration of a God-centered Judaism. At the same time, we suddenly see a phenomenon that we've never, so far as we know, experienced in Jewish history before, which is an intimacy between Jews, the Jewish people, and India, and to extraordinary proportions. 15 or 20 years ago, there were no relations, diplomatic relations, between India and Israel. I was in India in 1986, and we had no presence there. And you look at what's happening now, and it's just extraordinary. Now, okay, much of it is what it is, partying in Goa and backpacking, and that's part of it, and I don't begrudge kids who've spent 3 years in the army going off to have their India experience at whatever level it is. But I do think there's an inner meaning to this, the emergence of this connection, and that is that these are two ancient religious civilizations at either end of Asia that have been reborn in our time as uneasy secular democracies, and that each contain a profound wisdom of what it means to experience God's presence. We, the locus of Jewish spirituality in terms of our relationship to God has tended for the most part, with the exception of the Kabbalists and others, to really focus on the nation's relationship with God. All of our holidays, or most of our holidays, are expressions of historical moments of God coming close in history to the Jewish people. In India, the genius has been more on the emphasis on the individual soul encountering God, and especially on the meditation tradition. So, what does it mean that we are now encountering India? I think we have an enormous amount to learn from India in our efforts to renew the meditation tradition. The sense of how do I make God real in my individual life? We're very good at community, but I think that that's a step that needs to come later. We're at the step now where each individual Jew needs to start rethinking our relationship with God.
And to expand, as we talked before, this effect or this process in relation to the whole human community.
Well, look, I'll just make some random observations, and I don't have a systematic Torah here. So what comes? What does it mean that humanity has entered? Humanity is in an unprecedented state. We are the first generation that can't take mere continuity of humanity for granted. We're the first generation that knows that there is a very real possibility, and more people might even say a likelihood, that we might not survive. And we're not talking about the long term. You know, the remember the Woody Allen joke about hearing that the sun was going to expire in 10 billion years. And he expresses enormous relief. He said, "Oh, I thought it was 5 billion." You know? So we're not talking about a long, long term. There is very serious and growing anxiety about whether humanity will somehow be able to survive the next 100 years, given the nature of the weapons that we have, given the growth of terrorism, the growth of jihadism. The environment, and we don't know. We're the first generation that can take that for granted. Humanity, at this critical stage of its evolution, desperately needs the wisdom of those of its peoples that have ancient memories, or that have contiguous memories that run through all of the different eras of recorded history. I can think of almost no nation that has contiguous memory like that. The Jews have it. The Indians have it. Well, the Chinese had it. until communism. My sense is that the Chinese have lost an enormous amount of their capacity to retrieve memory. But one would have put the Chinese there too. And I mean, these are great civilizations that have ancient memory. Humanity needs that wisdom now in order to figure out how we're going to survive. And we need the wisdom of how do we connect, how do we turn to God? Because my feeling more and more is we don't have the wisdom or the capacity to survive on our own. If there is no God, there will be no humanity, given the threats that we're facing. That I have no doubt about. Just as I have no doubt that if there's no God, there would be no State of Israel. A State of Israel would not have come into existence, and it certainly would not have been able to sustain itself all these years. And every day that the State of Israel still exists, and we wake up in the morning, I think there should be a new prayer saying, you know, God, thank you for giving us one more chance today to get this right. And that's our survival depends more and more on the quality of our relationship with the powers that be that we call God. And our ability to focus the mercy of those powers in our direction. And there we really need the wisdom, the techniques, the insights of our ancient civilizations. And it's a very short list when I look at that list. I would certainly put the world's great religions on that list, like Christianity and Islam and Buddhism and Hinduism. I mean, we need the wisdom of the world faiths. And here, the better Judaism that we're able to create, the more worthy Judaism we're able to dredge up from our modern experience, the better world citizens we're going to be. The more we'll have something of value to say to humanity.
Sounds like a great ending, and I really appreciate your time. I know you're a busy dude. And we look forward to some other excuse to come and talk to you and hear what's rolling around in your silence.